Well, good afternoon, and on behalf of the National Pork Producers Council and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, I want to welcome you here to Fort Collins, Colorado, and to this afternoon's press conference. I'm Kevin Auctioner, and in addition to my work as an agribusiness consultant, I'm actually native of Fort Collins, Colorado. I grew up just south of town, third-generation Coloradoan, and actually my dad and grandpa were both born right here in Fort Collins when it was just a little bit more of an agricultural town than it is today. I'm also a graduate, and a proud graduate, I might add, of Colorado State University, and so we want to welcome you all to our beautiful campus, and we are open for donations, so there will be green and gold boxes there tomorrow that you can certainly donate to football team, animal science department, ag econ, whatever you choose. We're happy to take it. We come together here on the eve of what will certainly be a pivotal time for our industry and an important discussion over the next 24 hours. We have an opportunity over the next 24 hours to have a discussion about the proposed GPSA rule change and specifically to talk about the kinds of consequences that it would create and could create for the United States livestock industry. The specific purpose of this afternoon's press conference is to hear from some of our leaders in the pork and the beef industry and to get their insights and personal perspectives relative to what they believe the rule means and the kind of impact the rule could have on their own operations and the industry at large. Now, we also come together this afternoon for the press to have their opportunity to ask questions. We recognize the importance of media today. And we want to make certain that the press, both those of you who are in the room today as well as those of you who have joined us by phone, will have an opportunity to ask some questions that may be more time-pressed and more difficult to ask given tomorrow's very, very tight schedule. We'll begin today by hearing from the presidents of both the NCBA and the National Pork Producers Council. Following their introductory comments, we're going to ask each one of the panelists to make a brief presentation. And then after all the panelists have presented, we will open the floor up to questions. And, of course, those are questions from the media. Now, many of you know that we will also be having a reception and, I should say, dinner following this evening and should provide many of us who are producers and have similar questions or maybe additional questions the chance to interact with these industry leaders who are sitting up here at this table and ask questions ourselves. So to begin with, we'd like to hear from representatives of the two organizations who have organized this event this evening. And I'm pleased to introduce, first on the agenda, the current president of the National Pork Producers Council. He served the pork industry in a number of leadership positions, including being president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association and a member of the NPPC Board of Directors for the past 4 years. He's a member of the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation, the Iowa Cattlemen's Association, the Iowa Corn Growers Association, and the Iowa Soybean Association. He and his son Randy have a diversified crop, cattle, and hog operation where they raise corn, soybeans, cattle, and about 6,000 head of market hogs each year. Would you please help me welcome to the podium the 2010 NPPC President, Sam Carney.
Thank you, folks, and good afternoon. And it's nice to see such a large crowd, and I personally want to thank you for coming, taking time out of your busy schedules for today and tomorrow's events. As was previously mentioned, my name is Sam Carney, and I'm currently serving the president of NPPC. I especially want to thank you again for being here for this GPSA livestock rule. But I'm from Adair. My son and I, as he announced, we're a wing-to-finish operation. We also have a cow-calf, feed cattle, and do corn, soybeans, and hay. In addition to my fellow pork producers on this panel, I am here with producers from across the country representing a diversity of sizes and type of operations. Some of them are small. Some of them are medium-sized. Some are large independents. Some are contract growers. And some are employees of production entities. All of them are in the hog business because they love what they do, that's what they make their living doing, and they all and live and work in the rural areas throughout America. In a few minutes, you're going to hear from the panel and myself on how this could affect our business. Again, thank you for coming.
Now it's my pleasure to introduce a gentleman I've come to know over the last several years. He spent many years actively involved in the beef cattle industry. He's currently serving as the president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. He comes to us today from Astoria, Illinois, where he and his family own and operate Black Gold Ranch and Feedlot, an operation that includes about 5,000 acres of cropland and pasture, 1,200 mother cows, and a 5,000-head confinement feed yard. Incidentally, the Fogelsongs are also in the hog business. In fact, he produces thousands of feeder pigs each year. Would you please join me in welcoming NCBA President Steve Fogelsong?
Well, it's obvious that Sam and I have both been outed today. He's a hog guy that is masquerading as a beef guy, and I'm the opposite. So we are, both of us, at the end of the day, we're livestock guys, and both of us fully invested in that. And I think that's probably the deal. You know, species means nothing in this conversation. It's all about what we do for a living. This Gypsy deal is probably the one thing that I've had more phone calls and emails than anything else since I've been involved with NCBA. And it's interesting because not only have I had a lot of calls, but it's interesting about the breadth of the folks that have called me. It's order buyers. It's large feeders, small feeders. It's breeding folks, folks that raise bulls and heifers. And all of them ask me the same question. What are you going to do about this? Because as I look at this rule, this is going to take me out of business. I talked to a guy that ran a small packing plant the other day, you know, and the only way that he can stay in business is the fact that he buys a certain spec of hogs because he sells to Whole Foods, and he can only slip that in because of, you know, the fact that he can differentiate his deal. His perspective is he'll be out of business. We've gathered together a group of folks here, you know, they're going to give you their perspective on how this affects them. Many of you in the room, the press, you know, I've done umpteen different interviews over the last few weeks. And the one thing that I've tried to stress to people is take a listen to the folks that are going to put forward the facts about this matter and then apply that to your operation. And once you've done that, you make your own decision. You're all businessmen. You all know exactly how this stuff plays out in your business. Make your decision from there. But that's not enough. After you've made that decision, pick up a pen, email, do a letter, whatever you got to do, but call those folks in D.C. They're going to make that decision. Let them know your feelings, because unless they hear from you, don't expect anything other than just the average. Thank you very much.
Fortunate to have some great leaders in our livestock industry. We're going to begin today with our first panelist. She's the Vice President and General Counsel for the Kansas Livestock Association. Her work with KLA includes reviewing federal and state environmental regulations and lobbying on all issues affecting livestock. And she works closely, obviously, with NCBA in Washington, D.C. on a number of issues. Interestingly enough, from 1995 to 1999, Allie served as Kansas Secretary of Agriculture under Governor Bill Graves. Prior to becoming Kansas Secretary of Agriculture, Allie had worked for the Kansas Livestock Association as well. He also spent several years working in the public policy arena in Washington, D.C. on a number of issues. She has a bachelor's degree from St. Mary's of the Plains College. She earned her law degree from Washburn Law School, master's in agricultural law from the University of Arkansas, and she's here to provide us some context around what the rule really means. Would you help me in welcoming Allie Devine?
Thank you, and good afternoon. What we'd like to do today is give you a little background of kind of how we got here and what the issues are. First, I want to say that many of the points that we're going to discuss are not new to the industries. There are issues that have arisen over the last 10 years. I think many of you can remember 1990s where we had a similar discussions. This is the kind of the next generation of issues. Not to be remedial, but we're going to use the term GIPSA, which is Grain Inspection, Packers and Stockyards Administration, or the agency, what we might refer to off and on. A little background. The Grain Inspection, Packers and Stockyards Administration has authority over the Packers and Stockyards Act. You'll often hear lawyers talk about it as PSA or the Act. You'll hear those acronyms used today. I just want to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about. The primary focus of what we're going to talk about is the PSA has seven different prohibitions of what packers or marketing agents or dealers can or cannot do. Primarily two are the focus of most of the discussion of the proposed reg that came out on June the 22nd of 2010. The two areas that they're going to focus on is what is an unfair, unjustly discriminatory, or deceptive practice or device. The second is making or giving any undue or unreasonable preference or advantage to any particular person or locality. The PSA prohibits packers from doing those two things. The problem has been, historically, that those terms are not defined in the Act. So what we have seen is a body of case law that has evolved over giving meaning to these terms and to evaluate what packer practices are allowed and which are prohibited. In the last probably 6 to 7 years in particular, we have seen a number of cases brought by USDA and personal people making claims against packers that have been unsuccessful. And those largely are because the courts have required that there be a showing that the packers' actions caused a competitive injury or was likely to cause a competitive injury. Again, those are pretty broad terms, and part of the rule speaks to what are those terms. In 2008, the Farm Bill was debated. Many of these issues arose during the Farm Bill. This regulation carries forward some of those prior discussions. Many of the things that we'll talk about today were ideas or amendments offered during the 2008 Farm Bill discussions and were soundly defeated or withdrawn. So here we are again today talking about some of the main points. However, in the 2008 Farm Bill, there were things that the Congress directed GPSA to do. They talked about issuing regulations regarding certain terms of poultry and swine grower contracts. I want to make a distinction now between grower and marketing contracts. Grower contracts are those where the producers are raising the livestock for a particular market. Marketing contracts are a different animal. It is an arrangement, a contract sales arrangement. The two are not the same. The second thing that the Congress directed USDA to do was issue some regulations regarding arbitration. I can speak on behalf of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. We are not arguing about the arbitration provisions that are in this regulation. The third point, it called upon USDA to establish criteria to use to determine whether an undue or an unreasonable preference or advantage has occurred in violation of the Packers and Stockyards Act. Those were the directives of the Congress. What happened on June was that USDA issued responses to those things, plus a whole lot more. And it's the whole lot more that has captured the attention of our organizations. The first, and I want to make some general comments here before I really speak to the specifics of the law. Some general comments from attorneys. This is a pervasive invasion of government into private contractual relations in a way that we have not seen in this industry, especially in the beef industry, and we have not seen in other sectors of the economy. Second, the lawyers have a general perception that there is no recognition in the regulation for the differences between species. Ask any cattleman here if they're similar to a chicken. They'll tell you no. There's some very distinct operational differences between species that are not recognized by the regulation, so it becomes an overly broad application of the law or the proposed law to the facts of the industries. Finally, we want to talk about trial lawyers. In this proposed regulation, there is a lessening of the standards of what it takes to make a case, either by the government or by civil suits. The lessening of the standards is what opens the doors for trial lawyers. Let's talk about the regulation specifically. What does it do? I'm going to give you a very, very broad overview of it. The first thing it does is it requires packers to maintain written records to justify differential pricing. And I, if you'd like, I'd cite you to section 201.94 of the regulation. Making a premium payment and failing to maintain a justification for that premium is also a violation of the law or the proposed reg. It becomes an unfair practice in violation of section 201.210. It requires the packers to submit sample contracts of alternative marketing arrangements to USDA within 10 days of entering into the contract. Now, there has been some discussion of what is a sample contract, and I will tell you that the regulation does not speak to what a sample is, but what it does speak to is what is a marketing agreement, and it talks about what it would apply to. The law, the new proposed regulation, would apply to any marketing agreement, and it specifies what it is, and it says any modification, any change, I'm about cutting out here, any type of change to that original agreement, even if it's one in existence today, it can then be brought under the purview of this regulation. The producer information, in our estimation, is not protected. The packers, in submitting the contracts to USDA, can ask that certain confidential business information be protected. That same privilege is not given to producer information. Many say that by the requirement that it be a sample contract submission, that that doesn't pertain to individual information. However, in other sections of the regulation, it speaks to reporting of the unique circumstances of each contract. In our estimation, that gives USDA the authority to require all contracts to be submitted. If that is not the intent, we would ask that it be clarified. Another point that it talks about is it lists a number of things that packers should not do. Don't violate the Packers and Stockyards Act by giving an undue preference or an unreasonable preference or advantage. Again, the regulation specifies what are the types of scenarios that would be undue preferences. And I'm going to give you some what we think are very extreme examples. One. Whether contract terms are made available to all who individually or collectively meet the condition or of a contract if they are offered to one. This eliminates the producer's competitive advantage because the regulation fails to acknowledge that producers are competing for certain contracts in certain markets. Again, that's in section 201.211. The next part is whether information regarding the acquiring of livestock is made to all producers when disclosed to one or more. As a practical matter, what does that mean? Does that mean that a processor must post any offering on the website? What does it mean? What does it have? What practical application does it have? The next thing it calls for is that packers don't violate the Packers and Stockyards Act by engaging in unfair, unjustly discriminatory acts, which are now defined to include contract violations. And here, among attorneys, is where we have some serious, serious problems with the direction of the regulation. It is taking what has traditionally been contract violations and morphing them into violations of the Packers and Stockyards Act, and in some circumstances, violations of antitrust law. While that may not seem like much to many of you in the room, it is a major shift in policy. Again, what are the types of things that the regulation says are unfair or unjustly discriminatory acts? Things like any act that causes competitive injury or creates a likelihood of competitive injury, now defined to include such things as raises rivals' costs. Okay, how do you control somebody else's costs? Wrongfully depresses prices paid to a producer below market value. What's below market value?
a misuse of market power to distort competition. Distortions can be positive or negative. Impairs a producer's ability to receive reasonable expected full economic value from a transaction in a market channel or a marketplace. Whoever gets the full expectation of what they think their product is valued. It's a problem for the industry. The legal concepts that have been shifted, we think, open the doors to trial lawyers. We think it shifts agriculture into a new realm of regulatory framework that is not matched in any other industry. We would recognize and ask others to look at this regulation and talk about what it means to other industries. If this becomes the precedent for antitrust law, we have some serious, serious concerns for how industries in the United States will function. With that, we'll be ready to answer questions. I want to introduce Phil Kunkel. Phil Kunkel is an attorney with Gray, Plant & Moody. He has been working closely with the pork producers and is also working with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Thank you.
That provides some great context, and now we're going to move into our panel. As I mentioned, we're going to hear from four pork producers first, and to begin our discussion, we're going to want to call on Sam Carney, who is your president of the National Pork Producers. Sam?
Thank you. I've been asked to say, what does this mean to my operation? There are several things. I've read this rule several times. I'm no lawyer. I'm just a producer in Adair, Iowa. But it's not defined. It's very vague. People don't understand it. They don't know what to do. I've taken it. I've talked to legal advice. They look at me and they read it and they come back and they say, you know, we could be on this side of it, but the next day we could be on this side of it. It's so vague and undefined, we couldn't tell you where to go. So as a producer, I'm extremely scared, and I don't want to have that kind of risk. Another thing I don't like is risk management. The last 2-3 years, the livestock industry has been kind of tough. Things have got better now. But if there's one thing we've learned the last 2 or 3 years, you got to have risk management with the volatility of the livestock market today. And as in the pork industry, we've seen it hit hard last year when H1N1 hit us. The people that had risk management survived. The ones that didn't are no longer in business or had to sell some of their herd off. So what if I, as a producer, can't have a risk management? How do I go to my banker and get a loan? I wonder about this. It takes a lot of money to run an operation. So how do we do that? I don't know how to do that. And what's the banker going to tell me? He says, well, Sam, if you can't lock in your pigs, I'm not going to give you the money. So I'm kind of concerned about this. How is an independent producer such as myself going to stay in business? We have packer contracts. I like packer contracts. You can use the board. You can use cash. But if you have a contract with a packer, you don't have to have margin money for a board, which takes more money when you're already borrowing money. And if you use a cash market, you're at the volatility of whatever happens, and you never know when something can come in and lower the cash market. If anything, we need more options in this business, not less. And I don't think the government should be dictating that to us. So risk management is a very big issue that I have. I have swine growers. I have people that feed pigs for me. And I'll use an example. I have a producer that came to me 5 years ago. He said, Sam, my buildings aren't that good. I know what they're paying for pigs. I understand mine probably won't do quite as good, but I'm not going to charge you as much. This is what I want from my building. I took him up on that. I said, we'll do a trial run. Things work. We'll keep you. Today, that would be illegal in this. That producer, I would have to let go because I couldn't take the risk, and my banker would tell me, no, you're not putting pigs in there. Another thing is, what happens if we're losing a lot of money and the banks say, okay, we're going to let you keep operating, but we're going to cut you down 10%? How do I do that? I got to go to every one of those guys and cut down 10%, and their buildings hold this amount, but I got to cut it 10%? What am I going to do? Who's at risk? I don't know if banks are going to go for this either. That's another thing I'm concerned about. Another thing I've done over the years is delivery times. I've loaded pigs out at 11 o'clock on a Thanksgiving night. You're full. The last thing you want to do is go out 11 o'clock in the dark and start loading pigs. And the last thing you got employees wanting to do is come to work at 11 o'clock at night. So you have to pay them dearly. But I get paid for those pigs, and I get paid good for it. Today, if you went by this, this eventually would be illegal. Packers have done an excellent job. They've controlled when those pigs come in. It's animal safety. Just on that alone, you know, pigs come in, they're not sitting on trucks, and they eat the cold. I mean, sometimes things get mixed up, and you can't quite do it all right, but most of the time it's pretty good, and it's set that way. This, to me, you could deliver pigs whenever because you're going to get all paid the same. So I have a lot of concerns about this, how it's going to concern my business and how things will be going in the future. Producers in the livestock business, consumers have demanded for leaner meat for years. We've met that demand. Packers have paid us well for that. Some producers haven't done that. I'm not going to get paid anymore because I have leaner animals than somebody that just stayed the same way they did 30 years ago. I don't think that's right, and I think as producers, we shouldn't feel that's right. So how is this going to affect me? I think it's going to affect me a lot, and as an independent producer, I may not even be in business in the future if I let the government dictate how I'm going to operate. So with that, I'm going to turn it over.
Very good. Thank you, Sam. Mark Legan is a first-generation farmer who operates family operation in Coatesville, or near Coatesville, Indiana, with his wife, daughter, and son-in-law. After receiving his B.S. and a master's degree from Purdue University's College of Agriculture, he spent 6 years serving as an extension agent in Indiana before pursuing his lifelong dream of starting a family farming operation. Today, Legan Livestock and Grain produces about 58,000 wean pigs each year, and farms approximately 1,000 acres of corn and soybean. Mark provides his leadership as a board member in several organizations, including the NPPC Board of Directors, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management Water Pollution Control Board, and the Putnam County Community Foundation Board. He's also a deacon at Bethel Missionary Baptist Church. Please join me in welcoming Mark Legan. Mark?
Thank you, Kevin. Still trying to get used to these trifocals, so I may have to kind of juggle some notes here, but appreciate the opportunity to come to Colorado and share some of my thoughts with you here today. As Kevin mentioned, you know, our farm may be a little unique in the fact that we started about 21 years ago, basically with a dream, and we've made some business decisions. West Central Indiana used to be quite a few independent pork producers in there, and I've seen a lot of my neighbors choose to go out of business, whether it be because of age or not wanting to make the investment, capital investment, to stay in business. And two things, I guess, that have allowed us to continue to be in business, or one is a good wife that's willing to sign notes, and another is a good bank that we've worked with for 21 years and going along with us and doing that. We have seen a lot of changes. I think all of the livestock industries have, but probably pork as much, if not more so, than some of the others. We've worked hard at trying to be efficient. And a big thing that whenever I think of efficiencies, I think of efficiencies of scale. And, you know, we started out 20 years ago with 160 sows, basically in a 50-50 arrangement. And we were able to work with some neighbors in that for about 6 years, and some other opportunities came up in the neighborhood, and we were able to purchase a farm on contract and grow that farm then to the operation we have today, which by a lot of measures is not large, but when you're trying to juggle that with some extracurricular activities, some days it's more than plenty of work, that's for sure. But not only have we grown because trying to take advantage of the efficiencies of scale, but we've also tried to partner every chance we get, whether it's the neighbor who also purchases weaned pigs from us, that we take our 1,000-acre crop operation and make it look like a lot bigger operation from the standpoint of being able to purchase inputs, share machinery, share labor. I don't have a desire to be a big farmer. I just want to be able to take some of the advantages that the larger farms have. So in the cropping operation, we can purchase inputs and to a certain extent even do some marketing together with the neighbor and share the machinery. We've worked hard at trying to manage risk over the years too. And when you manage risk, you're not going to hit home runs every day. We just hope to be able to be back up at the plate, swinging away day to day. And this risk management, I think, is going to play an increasing role in the future as we look at volatility in the markets and something that, you know, whenever we try to manage risk, we've got a lot of tools available to us, and some of those are impacted by this GPSA rule, in my estimation, quite a bit. And particularly when it comes to production contracts and also marketing contracts, and I'll touch on those a little bit later here. Was mentioned that we're bringing a second generation into the farm. Sent a daughter off to Purdue for 4 years and worked on her master's, and not only did she decide she wanted to come back to the farm, but she brought a husband also that worked on his master's work there in animal science. So a great, probably, you know, of all we've been able to accomplish, those are some of the things that make me the proudest, that she wants to be involved and has the passion for not only agriculture, but the livestock industry going forward in the future. And I can talk about the changes we've seen in the last 20 years, but change is going to come even faster as we go forward. And we've got to be ready to meet that change. And our farm is going to look different in the future than it looks now. And we've got to be able to use, as I mentioned, the tools that we have available. And we have used production contracts in the past, and considering pretty heavily here in the future as we make business decisions for our farm. Production contracts are a way that allow us to manage risk. We don't have to have as much capital invested in fixed assets. Also, from a labor standpoint, it helps us on that. And the people that we've been hooked up with in the past, I know, certainly have appreciated the extra income they've received there. In some instances, it's allowed another generation to come back to their farm. And a big thing right now in the Midwest is being able to utilize the manure in their cropping operations. And, you know, the industry has gone to production contracts for a lot of reasons, and I think those are some of them. Certainly nobody's holding a gun to somebody's head asking them to build contract buildings. People have done it, and in our part of the world, I think if you would ask the pork contractors that own the buildings if they would want to own the pigs and stand the risk and the volatility in the market, probably 75 to 80% of them are happy where they're at, and will continue to do so as long as they can. And I think it was mentioned earlier that Allie talked about the poultry contracts, and I think I'd just like to mention that from what I understand, and it's very little, the poultry contracting business It's a whole different set of contracts than what we deal with on the pig side of things. Most of our contracts are set up on a per pig space per year payment schedule, as opposed to a turn by turn. And most people, I think, are pretty happy with that. Talk about marketing contracts too, and there's a lot of discussion over the last several years about the thinness of the spot market. And a lot of pigs are sold even on production contracts that go back to the spot market. Am I concerned about the thinness of the spot market? Yeah, I think I am. But, you know, as a producer, I understand why the spot market is so thinly traded anymore. And, one of the reasons is, as I mentioned, I want to manage my risk, and I can do that through marketing contracts. Also, when we go through periods of high production, I want to make sure I've got a place to go with my pigs, that they can be killed. And if we get back into another 1998 where we've got more pigs than we have slaughter space, that really presents a challenge for people in the spot market. I think most independent producers right now today would rather be in the spot market than having a market contract. But here again, it goes back to this idea of trying to manage risk. I guess as we talk about this proposed gypsy rule, a couple other things that really concern me is this idea of packer-to-packer sales. I know in my part of the world in Indiana, there's one of our larger slaughter plants, pork slaughter plants, also has a series of buying stations that buys a lot of sows, and we sell sows to them, and that's actually one of the main competitors whenever we try to sell sows, but they don't kill any. So this rule directly would impact those people that buy sows and cull breeding stock that would resell them. And in fact, if this rule was implemented, it would create less competition in that market. Also, in the past, we have been part of a marketing co-op. And, as I read this rule too, it concerns me that by being part of a co-op, whether it be marketing or we've even looked at some opportunities to join into some packing co-ops, about what that would do to our ability to, if we didn't tie all of those pigs up at one time, to sell to other packers by being associated with that co-op. It's pretty easy to sit here and talk about things we don't like, but sometimes we sort of need to step back and talk about things that we appreciate that we have today. And I'm all for market access. I can call within the state of Indiana and four different packers or five and get a bid on hogs and try to get them scheduled in. And I have that now, and I want to be able to keep that ability if I choose. I'm for market transparency, and we have this thing called mandatory price reporting, and I think that's real important as we talk about this issue, that I know what pigs are being sold for, and I can make decisions whether I think I'm being treated fairly or if I need to find another packer to go with the pigs. And I also like having the ability to react to market signals. I think all of the livestock industry in the last decade or two has done an excellent job of producing a product that the consumer is wanting. And a lot of that's come about because of quality grades or incentives to produce that. The comment was made that if the gypsy rule was to go through, the idea that packers would have to be able to document why they pay more for one type of pig or one type of calf than another. So, we've got to have the ability to react to market signals. the way we market pigs today is going to be different than the way we market pigs in the future. This new mandatory price reporting law that's being negotiated or discussed right now has a wholesale price reporting for meat cuts. I think that's going to be extremely important to those of us in the pig industry as we go forward. But the more information we can have and utilize as producers to make decisions, the better off we are. As you can imagine, I'm against government involvement as long as the markets are working. And I think that the markets are working now. I'm against burdensome paperwork in my business in the production and marketing agreements. We're all of these sort of things have a cost associated with them, whether we believe it or not. And we're in a global marketplace. We're competing against the Brazilians, the Europeans for pork on the shelf space in Asia and around the world. And anything that we do that adds cost to that product ultimately hurts our competitive advantage. And I also believe that this rule actually would drive integration faster. And the reason being, I think there are a lot of packers and integrators that would decide, instead of dealing with the contract production systems, that they would find it more cost effective from a litigation standpoint just to own all of their own pigs instead of working with independent producers and independent contractors. And I guess it's for those reasons that I think GPSA should consider pulling this rule back and rewriting a rule dealing with explicitly what the Farm Bill intended. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Our next panelist comes to us from Marshall, Missouri, and he is the manager for Ham Hill Farms Incorporated. Ham Hill Farms is a family corporation that includes 5,000 acres of corn, soybeans, and wheat, also a 3,000 head plus sow farrow to finish operation. Currently is a member of the board of directors for the Missouri Pork Association and for the Saline County Farm Bureau, where he also serves as chairman of the legislative committee and is no newcomer to the politics of agriculture. Previously has served as chairman and treasurer of the Missouri Pork Association. He also remains active in his local community, having served as past president of the St. Luke United Church of Christ and a coach for the local Optimist Little League baseball team and the Marshall Youth Soccer League. All right, so there's a soccer dad. That's what we've been looking for. Please welcome Brent Sandage.
Thank you. That soccer thing, the only reason I was a soccer coach, nobody else knew anything about soccer either, and I just got selected. I'm going to take a little different stab at this thing, because we had a price discrimination bill that was passed by the Missouri legislature in 1999, so I've got some real firsthand experience with how devastating it can be. Like I said, it passed in 1999. It had a court challenge, and then it had an appeal, and it finally became law on May 29th of 2001. There were several livestock people, livestock organizations were really talking to the legislature about how they'd screwed up, and by September, the governor called a special session, and one of the main things that they dealt with was try to straighten out the mess that they created. They passed three amendments at that time that helped straighten it out. But it took a while for these amendments to take effect and for people to understand them. And so the markets didn't return to normal for quite a while. And that law eventually expired on December 31st of 2002. The problems that thing created was, one, is some packers just simply buying livestock and quit buying livestock in Missouri because they didn't, want to take the risk of being sued. Some of them altered their practices considerably, to minimize that risk, and then definitely the prices were lowered. This price discrimination law was in effect for only 4 months, but it lingered on, you know, until the Packers really felt confident that there wasn't going to be a lot of lawsuits, and they understood it. Dr. Ron Plain at the University of Missouri studied the St. Joe Stockyards hog market for that summer, and it was averaging $3.37 a hundred lower than Sioux City during the summer of 2001. The previous year, in that same time period, it was only $1.04 lower. So it was over $2 a hundred that it was costing Missouri pork producers. Also, Dr. Plain, estimated the passage of that price discrimination law in Missouri, livestock price discrimination, cost us between $19 and $20 million to the Missouri livestock producers. And about two-thirds of that was shouldered by pork producers. You know, Packers didn't know how this price discrimination law was going to be defined by the courts, and the Missouri legislature created 70,000 potential plaintiffs for them. I was rather lucky in that we had a written contract at the time, and it didn't affect what we were getting. But fellow pork producers who had oral agreements or were selling on the cash market, it was costing them, I know producers that told me it was costing them over $5 a hundred, you know. And because, and one producer that I know in particular, I mean, he was spending tremendous amounts of money on breeding stock trying to produce a quality product. Well, he wasn't getting paid any different than the person who went out and bought a $150 boar, you know, because they just, nobody knew how this discrimination was going to be, how they were going to deal with it. You know, and another thing that I personally definitely would contribute to this, we had a packing plant in my hometown at the time. It closed right after this. Now, I don't know, it was just always awfully coincidental to me that closed about the same time that this was going on. But what I felt was, you know, Missouri had just passed a law that just said, well, we really don't want the livestock business in the state of Missouri. And, you know, what that cost my hometown when that closed, they were spending $50,000 a month with utilities with the city of Marshall. We went from 900 jobs to about 150, and my pigs all of a sudden, instead of going about 5 miles, had to go 221 miles. And I think we need to do everything we can to encourage packers and encourage competition, and this definitely was a definite negative. You know, the thing that's really important to this is we've grown, our farm's grown from little or nothing to a 3,000 sow fair to finish operation that raised most of its corn. And we did it, you know, by investing in technology and competing, and we do a lot of things. Like Mark said, I market in a group, we buy in groups, we act big, we just do things, but we're doing things to be competitive. And I've got a couple of kids that would like to come back to this farm. But if we can't manage risk, if we can't have you know, free and open markets like we have now, you know, I don't know. There's much chance for them, and it's a big concern to me. And I think this gypsy rule would definitely put a nail in the coffin for the livestock business here in the U.S.
Thank you, Brent. Our final speaker from the pork industry comes to us with degrees in agricultural economics from Oklahoma State University and Iowa State University. Sure you don't want one from Colorado State?
I'd like that.
All right. He served as director of economics for the National Pork Producers Council and the National Pork Board from 1993 to 2002. He's currently the president and actually the founder of Paragon Economics, an economic consulting firm focused primarily in livestock and meat marketing. He's also the lead author of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange Daily Livestock Report. Please join me in welcoming a familiar face to the hog industry, Mr. Steve Meyer.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here, and I guess the first thing I want to say is I'm an industry observer and an economist, and as such count far less than the three people that have just talked to you who have their livelihoods on the line every day in this business. I have to admit that mine's pretty much on the line too, but not as directly as they are, and I'm sure I don't get as sweaty and hardworking as they are. So let's point that out first. As an economist, when I look at this proposed rule from GPSA, it bothers me on a number of fronts. The biggest one is that as you read this rule, it looks as though, I mean, the goal here is homogeneity. One price, equality of outcome in the marketplace. I'm all for equality, but I think the equality in the United States is equality of opportunity. And that doesn't necessarily mean that every outcome is going to be the same. When I read the rule, it looks to me like what they have in mind, Steve, is perfect competition model that we use, and it's a model of economics that's important because it's used to teach economics. But it's a model that also is not very well replicated in the real world because it has a few assumptions to it. And several are instantaneous adjustment, atomistic or very small buyers and sellers, and many of them. Homogeneous product. All the products in a perfectly competitive model are the same. No geographic differences. Instantaneous adjustments. Complete information on the part of all parties. Now, it's a great model for teaching economics, but again, it doesn't really find much of a home in the real world. And it's one of the models, and it's a model from one of the economic principles we learn is the law of one price. And in a perfectly competitive model, you have one price. But when you start relaxing those assumptions of that model, you end up getting a lot of other things because you don't have perfect information on anybody's part. We're all kind of working on our best information about what the future might be. We certainly don't have homogeneous products. I mean, they're all over the map. And in some cases, we make a decision to make a product different in order to hopefully capture a higher value. I'm concerned by the rule because risk and uncertainty always equals costs. And in the long run, consumers have to pay all costs. And so I think if this rule as written now was to become the law of the land, that we would see much higher costs of doing business in our livestock systems, and that would result in lower prices for producers and higher prices for consumers. And in fact, GPSA did research that tells us exactly that. Their study that was published 2 years ago points out very clearly that banning the use of alternative marketing agreements or even impacting them or limiting them would in the long run hurt producers and consumers and would make packers no better off or worse off in the process. And it seems kind of silly to me to be doing something that your own research tells you isn't a good idea. When you take this and you make production contracts more expensive and more risky to use, you're going to have less production contracting, meaning that owners of livestock will own the buildings that they grow their animals in. And that's an important thing in the pork industry and it's an important thing in the chicken industry. I was just with Bill Roenick, the head economist for the National Chicken Council, who said specifically that he thinks that chicken companies would start owning growing buildings instead of contract growing with contractors. I think that would happen in the pork industry too, and that would take away a lot of this opportunity that Mark talked about, the people in his community to not only have a job that paid them, but to build equity in a business over time, and I think that makes better citizens and better people in our communities. If you make marketing contracts more expensive to use, we're going to use less marketing contracts. But unlike the people that are proponents of this, I don't think that means a lot of hogs are going to go back to being traded in spot markets or at the local auction barn, and certainly not at the terminal markets, Gary, because there aren't any anymore. And the reason there aren't any is they're costly. So what's going to happen is going to create a tremendous incentive for vertical integration. And by the way, I don't think that the people that wrote this are silly enough that they don't know that that's what's going to happen. Maybe I'm looking a little too sinister at that, but I think they realize that. There's the other point I would make is in my 20 years working in the pork industry, I know of no contractual arrangement that's out there that has been coercive on either side. They were all entered into by two parties looking to better their lot in life by signing an agreement that was mutually beneficial for them. Now, in some cases, those things work out and they're not exactly what everybody hoped for. And that means that you have to reconcile differences. But I don't think you make them a violation of federal law when those differences come to blows. And that's what this law, as it would be, would do. Lastly, on this point, species are much different. A lot of this came, especially on the production contract side, came from problems that showed up in the chicken industry. Again, after 20 years of experience, I don't know of very much of this happening in the pork industry. Our contracts are very different. They're long-term in nature. We enter them for 3 or 5 or 8 years at a pop. We pay on an ongoing basis, not a turn-by-turn basis. There's nobody held hostage in any way in these. And so we need to recognize those differences when we start writing rules that apply to all the species. And this rule doesn't recognize those differences in the least. Finally, I'm going to make one point as a citizen and not as an economist. I have a real problem with bureaucrats who try to rewrite the laws of the land through a regulation that the ideas have clearly been completely refuted by our courts and our Congress. And this idea that you can have a violation that does not affect competition and still be a violation of the Packers and Stockyards Act is that one. The courts have said that's not the case. The courts have said that is not the case. Both houses of Congress took up that idea in the last Farm Bill and said that's not a good idea, and yet this set of bureaucrats decided they would write a regulation that made that the law. As a citizen, I have a real problem with that, and I hope you do too.